começando mais uma live rebelde especial, internacional, onde nós vamos conversar com o Dr. Stephen Russi. E vamos aguardar o pessoal aí entrando, vamos aguardar aí o Dr. Russi entrar também. Para quem não conhece, o Dr. Russi, ele é o autor do livro Understanding the Heart, um dos melhores livros que eu já li, excepcional esse livro. E estava na minha lista dos melhores livros de 2022. Ele já está aqui, vamos entrar. I send you the invitation so you can join us in the transmission. Let's see if it's going to work now. This is the second time I begin a transmission. It seems that the first time Dr. Russi wasn't able to join us. Oi, Carlinha. Bom dia, Márcia. Bom dia, Rita. Bom dia, Patrícia. Let me see. Okay, let me accept this solicitation. I think it's gonna work. Sometime it's gonna work. I don't know what is going on. He's not.
I can't hear you though. I can't hear you. Can you hear me? I don't hear you.
Can you hear me?
Turn my mic off. I can't hear you. Now I can hear you. Okay, good.
Yeah, I'm hearing you.
All right, good.
I think it worked out. It worked out. Thank you for your time, Dr. Russi. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Ah, fine. Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you to join us. First of all, let me say that your book was just mind blowing. 2 years ago, I read it, and it was so many different concepts and so many new concepts that I began to study it, and it was just a great reading, and it entered the list. I have a 5-book list every year that I publish, that I posted in Instagram, and your book was one of the greatest of 2022.
Nice.
And it begins with a very interesting story, your personal story of a heart attack. Can you, before we begin to talk about this, can you just tell a little bit about yourself and how did you became interested in evolution? Your first book was about evolution in medicine, the theory of evolution. How a chiropractor began to get some interest in these things?
Well, you know, I guess I was just, because of my own health journey, you know, as a kid, I had lots of chronic inflammatory conditions, everything from asthma to allergies to, I used to break out in hives all over my body. I had irritable bowel syndrome. Ultimately ended up with autoimmune type 1 diabetes, lots of inflammatory things as a kid. And so I guess that those conditions just kind of forced my hand as far as like be interested in health. And that didn't really happen until college, I guess. But Throughout my childhood, my doctors always told me there was this one way of doing things, and that was, the Western medical way of doing things. And I found that in college, I found that the way I lived my life had an impact on how I could manage these things and ultimately get rid of most of them. So I thought that was interesting that this Western medicine philosophy never really told me those things. And so it made me very curious about health and about life in general, like why is life here? Why is life on this planet? Because if you figure that out, and how life sustains itself, then it's probably going to give you an indication of how to achieve better health. So it was just kind of this never-ending curiosity that I still have, that I'm still investigating things. And so, I would just read a lot of stuff about health and different theories and things, and I guess eventually I came across evolution. And so I like framing things or seeing things from an evolutionary perspective. It makes sense to me, even though there's critiques of, exactly what Darwin found, and what it means. It still makes sense from a evolutionary perspective that things don't adapt very fast. They takes many, many generations to for a species to adapt to something. It's not like I can change the way my physiology works to adapt to something that changes in my environment. Like my physiology is pretty set, and that change happens over time, over generations, many, many generations. And so that kind of made sense to me. And then I was like, well, then it must be the environment that's changing so fast, because in order for a species to survive, it can't be sick, right? And we're one of the sickest populations, at least in the West, in the world. So it's like, well, that doesn't make sense. There's no way that our physiology would have evolved to be sick if it was in the right environment, right? So then it must be that the environment has changed too much. And so then I started looking into that, and you find out that it has in the last, 200, 300 years, which is a very evolutionary short amount of time. Even the last 10,000 years is still a very evolutionarily short amount of time, compared to the full time that humans have been on Earth. Things have changed quite rapidly, and if you look at the changes that have happened, it makes sense. You can match them up with the disease processes we're seeing, and why our bodies react to that. Because our bodies don't want to be sick; they're just reacting to the environment they're in and doing the best they can. If they get the wrong signals, then they're gonna express themselves in the wrong way. So just it made sense to me, and to frame my thoughts and my arguments that way.
You're completely right. And if you think about evolution, I have a biology almost full degree in my background, and I always saw things about in the lens of evolution. And when we see all this evolutionary mismatch that we have today, and we can just put all about all diseases, all chronic diseases at least, you can put in this basket, and that's it. We have something to learn about our evolution, and so tell me a little about what happened to you, about your heart attack, and how this started a new path, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I had learned a lot from, looking at things from an evolutionary perspective, and I'd always been very diligent about diet. It was the one thing I could control. Even though you can't control a lot of things that have changed in our environment, I could change that. And so that was kind of my bread and butter, so to speak. Even though I don't eat bread, that was my thing. I could hone in on my diet and make sure that that was what it was supposed to be, but that wasn't enough. I am type 1 diabetic, and that's kind of collateral damage from the inflammatory conditions I had as a kid. So that heavily predisposes me to heart disease. And so that's something that I've kind of taken an interest in. I've looked into a lot, because I've been told my whole life that, my vascular system is going to go bad, because I have higher blood sugars, and no matter how hard I try, they're always going to be a little higher than the average person who's not diabetic. And so, yeah, despite my best efforts as far as diet goes, 3 years ago, or a little over 3 years ago now, had a heart attack, a pretty massive one. I had 100% blockage of my left anterior descending artery, which is the quote unquote widowmaker heart attack, you know?
Yeah.
And there was no atherosclerosis in my arteries. There was no stenosis or calcification. I had a CAC score done 6 months prior, nothing. It was just a spontaneous clot that formed in the artery. And so there was a lot of things that I was aware of that I wasn't doing necessarily. Some because I didn't have the money to do yet, and others just because, like infrared, but others that I just wasn't doing yet. And so I kind of learned that I needed to do those things. And then on top of that, I went through a lot of stress, probably the 6 to 8 months before the heart attack. And it was that compiling on itself. And then I got some of the most stressful news of my life a day and a half before I had the heart attack. It was news about a close family member that was in a little trouble. And it wasn't only that it happened, it was that the inability of me or anyone in my family to get to this person to help them, because they were in another country and it was during COVID, you couldn't go anywhere. So it was stressful. And then I woke up a day and a half later and had a heart attack. So all of these different things kind of combined. And I think there was an aspect of dehydration. I think there was an aspect of low mineral status. And then there was these kind of more or less acute stresses that happened. This chronic stress combined with that acute stress that I think triggered clotting. And if you look at stress, the clotting factors in the blood go up tremendously under stress. And then you combine that with dehydration. And then I tried in unwisely to do a very intense workout that morning in that state of stress. And I think that was a straw that broke the camel's back. Because as soon as I did that workout, maybe 15, 20 minutes later, as soon as my body calmed down from the workout, clot formed. And it was pretty unmistakable what was happening. It wasn't like, you hear people sometimes like, I kind of felt this weird sensation, but I went on and then I wound up in the hospital later and I said, oh, yeah, you're having a heart attack. And they're like, oh, really? It was very unmistakable for me. It was intense pain right in that spot that was unwavering and very clear that something was wrong. So yeah, well, at first I was pretty, dejected and I was pretty, I felt like a hypocrite and I was like, I couldn't even prevent this in myself and all this stuff. But then when I was in the hospital, I got, like, having all the information that I knew.
How old
and
were you at that time?
34. Yeah. And so knowing the stuff that I knew at the time, and kind of the shortcomings of Western medicine, and then being directly in that system and seeing how it operates, it was almost reinvigorating for me to see that and be like, yeah, this happened to me, but what they're telling me is going to get me right back in here, And so, like, knowing that, knowing the information that I have, I wanted to keep spreading the information. And it's because people are going to be in that same situation I was, unfortunately. They need to be able to make educated decisions. And you can't do that without all the information. And some of that information that you're getting from Western medicine is one side of things. It's part of the story. But there's a whole lot more as to what the heart is and how the heart functions and how clots form and why they form that Western medicine is completely lacking in understanding. And so it's not the people in Western medicine's fault. It's just what they're taught. It's all we know when it's not all we know. There's a lot of evidence out there from very smart researchers who've dedicated their life to this stuff, and they show a completely different story of the vascular system. And it's really embracing that and trying to understand that got me to where I am today, as far as like what I know and what I do, as far as how I'm going to prevent this from ever happening again, and then help other people prevent it as well. So it's more like a unfortunate thing that happened, but it pushed me, like you said, like almost a different direction, not even a different direction. It pushed me, like, the things that I was doing beforehand, I'm still doing those things today. I'm just doing a lot more because I understand a lot more about why clotting happens and what causes that. So yeah, it pushed me to do a lot more and add a lot more to my regimen and stuff.
The idea to write the book was born in this period, or it was already on planning?
It was already happening. I was probably like 3/4 done with it. And then the heart attack happened. And so then I got to add in things about my experience in the hospital, and I got to add in other things. But even since the book came out in 2022, I could probably make the book 50% longer at this point, because of the things that I could add, and more things that I understand and grasp better, and have more evidence for, in the book. Like, yeah, there's just so much out there, because it's been so heavily researched, not just in the traditional way you think of, but yeah. So the book was kind of before, and if I ever get the chance to do a second edition, I can't wait to, because it'll be way more information.
Yeah. And is there any plan to translate the book to Portuguese?
That's a question for the publisher. I think that not right now.
Far, definitely.
Yeah, but if it does better, then I think that they would be motivated to do that. So that's the key, is getting it to do better. And I'm working on that, trying to promote it as much as I can. I have a lot of speaking engagements this year, so yeah.
Okay. That's if it it will be translated, it will be gonna be great. I have several friends, cardiologists, as we call here in Brazil, and they're very outside of the box thinkers, and it's a great book to present them,
For sure.
to give as a gift. And one of the things, one of the points that I found really fantastic about what in your book was the understanding that the heart was not a pump, or at least not a pump as we think it is. And how exactly is the heart doing his job? If it is, if it isn't a pump, what is it?
Yeah, so heart has three roles in the body, and it does do a very small amount of quote unquote pumping, but it's no more than enough to just move the blood through the chambers of the heart itself. There's
Okay.
no way a heart our size could forcefully pump and be the main reason that blood moves throughout the entire body. And there's lots of literature that shows that, researchers that have shown that this is like, if we look at the heart as a pressure propulsion pump, like a pump that forcefully sucks in fluid from somewhere and then forcefully pumps it out somewhere else. If we look at it as a system like that, it's about 15 to 20% efficient, something like that, maybe up to 30%, which doesn't make sense, like evolutionarily, or if you believe in, God, if you think that it was created, like it doesn't make sense to create or evolve something that inefficient,
Perfect.
right? And expect it to actually function, so then we can't really view it as a pressure propulsion pump, and that's because it's not. So the main roles of the heart are, one, the heart is organized in a, like the muscles of the heart is organized in a spiral-like fashion. So like the heart is actually one big band of muscle that is kind of wrapped up on itself, and it forms these chambers as it does this. And so when it contracts, it kind of spins, like an American football would spin when you throw it, it spirals. And so when it contracts, it spins like this. And that spinning creates a vortex of blood. So it swirls the blood around. And also when the blood moves through the valves and into the chambers, it kind of swishes around. It's the heart is there to kind of, I guess, mix up the blood, swish it around, and kind of create, just like we see water in a river is getting swished up, or coming out of a spring, like or through the earth, it's getting tossed around, so to speak. And the reason that is because because there's like 50% of the blood, or about 50% of the blood, is water. And when water gets swished around, it becomes energized, which we can talk about later why that's important. But it becomes energized, which is very important, for our physiology and the movement of blood in the periphery. So the heart is vortexing this blood around. The second reason the heart is there is because if we were to exert ourselves and exercise, the tissues, the muscles mainly, would need a lot of blood and oxygen and nutrients delivered to them. And so all the blood would rush over to the arterial side, being delivered to the tissues. And not enough blood would stay in the venous side if that happened, and the venous side would collapse and we would die. And so what the heart does is it actually slows the flow of blood. And they've shown this in studies with endurance athletes, with soccer players, that the heart gets bigger in endurance athletes, not because it's better at pumping blood, but because it's better at slowing the flow of blood as it's rushing back in there. So if the heart wasn't there, again, during exertion, all the blood would go over to the arterial side and the venous side would collapse. So the heart's there to maintain the pressure between the two systems so that doesn't happen. And then the third reason the heart is there is because of the mitochondrial density of the heart tissue, it gives off the biggest electromagnetic field of any organ in the entire body. And that electromagnetic field is the only one that's big enough to be able to kind of touch or sense or monitor every other cell in the body. So the heart is the measure of what's called coherence. Coherence is just the ability of a system to be synced up and communicating as a whole, to do what's best for the system as a whole. And the heart is what's monitoring that coherence, how well all of our cells are synced up and communicating so that we get a coherent signal to the heart. So you can think of coherence is really important because inner-body communication is important for you to be able to encounter stress and adapt to it. Kind of like in a workplace, if you've got 30 employees and they're all competing with each other, they don't get along, or there's a competition created between like who tries to get ahead in the company and everything. If that company encounters a stress and the employees aren't communicating well, everybody's out for themselves, that company's not going to handle that stress very well. You know, it's very likely the company will take big losses or even go under. However, if you have a company of 30 employees that are synced up, communicating well, they're all there for a common goal, which is the success of the company. Their pay is not competing with each other, this kind of stuff. That company encounters a stress, everyone's going to bind together, communicate, and handle that stress very well. And that's what coherence is. So we want our body to be intercommunicating well like that. And there are things that can interfere with that so that we get that cohesive response to stress. And the heart is what's measuring that state of coherence and then conveying that to the brain. And so then the brain responds through the nervous system based on how coherent or incoherent we are. So that's what they are. Those are the three roles of the heart: a vortex to maintain pressure between two systems, and then electromagnetic field to monitor coherence.
Interesting. And to in a certain way, the ancient people who tell us that the heart was the center of the body, they are not completely wrong. Mm-hmm. The heart is, in fact, the center, because if you talk about coherence and the communication that all the body can be sensed by the heart, the heart begins to make some sense about being center, about being the site of love and things like that, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, think about it like this. So people think of the nervous system and the brain, the central and peripheral nervous system, as what's controlling our body. But the nervous system is just the messenger. It's kind of like the nervous system is like the mail, the postal service, right? So the postal service doesn't dictate what messages are sent or where they're sent. It just takes in information, goes to the mailbox, it takes it in, it sees the information, it says, okay, this goes here. That's what the nervous system does. It doesn't change that information, doesn't open it up to receive it, it just communicates it, okay? What dictates the information that is sent is our environment. Our environment is the information. There are various things in our body that help us interpret that environment, so receive the information. And that is our senses, you know, sight and smell and taste and touch and hearing. And then it's the fascia system of the body has tons and tons of sensory nerve sensors that relay that information to the nervous system. But the heart is also a very big sensor of our environment. It's the heart's electromagnetic field is what allows us to sense somebody else in the room or sense the emotional state or our emotional state. There's a reason that we say things like, I love you with all my heart, not I love you with all my brain, right? Because it's not really in control. You can put your mind to something and that kind of thing, but the emotional state and what's driving how we feel in our current state is how we feel in our heart. And so that's an interesting thing. So there's always ways that we can sense that information and pick it up. And that information is relayed to the nervous system, and the nervous system just says, okay, this is what we do with this information. So the nervous system is not really in control of anything. It's just the messenger. And the way we change the way the nervous system acts is we affect the information, which is our environment. We put our environment in a different state, whether that's our light, our food, our electromagnetic fields, our relationships. No matter, there's all kinds of things that are informing our system of how to react.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And the drive to do something, the motivation to do something, it's not coming from the brain. It's coming from the heart. You do with all your heart. That's very interesting. And if the heart is not a pump, you said that it not pumps the blood. What makes the blood turning in your vascular system? That's a good question, because everyone, quote unquote, knows that the heart pumps the blood. But if not the heart, who is pumping?
So there's really no pump, and like there's systems in the body, there's fluid in the body that doesn't have a pump associated with it, like the cerebrospinal fluid around the brain and spinal cord, or the lymphatic system. There's no pumps in those systems. So how does that fluid move, right? Yeah. And it's the same way that the blood moves. So, well, there's a few ways that blood moves. The main one is the blood is about half water. And so water is probably the most amazing fluid on the planet. And we are on a water planet. We are made of water. It is very, very relevant. It's not just this inert thing that biochemistry is happening in. It's actually very alive, and it's what drives our physiology. But water has unique properties in that it can hold energy. This is energy in the form of light mostly. But when it holds energy and it gets next to a hydrophilic surface, or a water-loving surface, which all surfaces in the body are hydrophilic, then it actually structures itself into a different phase of water. So we're told there's solid, liquid, gas. You know, there's ice, water, and vapor, air vapor, or steam. But there's actually a fourth phase of water that happens when water holds energy and gets next to a water-loving surface. And this phase is kind of between solid and liquid. It's kind of more like a gel. So you can think of it like Jell-O, or like the consistency of a raw egg white, that kind of gelatinous feeling. And it's most of the water in my body is made up of that gel. Like you can take my tissue, my forearm, you can move it around. It feels like a gel, right? Because it gives, but it bounces right back. But there's in the blood, there's liquid water. But some of that liquid water will structure itself onto the lining of the artery, okay? Because the lining of the artery is a hydrophilic surface, and they've shown that this happens in animals, in animal vasculature systems, in Dr. Pollock's lab at University of Washington. And so what happens, it's really fascinating, because water is H2O, right? Yeah. And if you take H2O and you put it with energy and you put it next to the hydrophilic surface, it actually, the energy makes it able to cleave off one of the hydrogens, the H pluses, and those other oxygens and hydrogens team up with the other oxygens and hydrogens that are left from water cleaving off a hydrogen, and they form this lattice-like structure that stacks up on that hydrophilic surface. And this is a gel layer, right? And that gel layer has some pretty interesting properties. One, it's very electronegatively charged. Two, nothing can really penetrate it, so it protects the lining of the arteries. But because it's very electronegatively charged, and then the hydrogens that were cleaved off are very positively charged. There was a negative area next to a positive area, and that's a battery. Because if you take a battery, when you put it into something, you're always trying to align the positive and negative sides, right? That's a battery. And they've actually shown that when you create structured water and you put an electrode into the negative structured water into the positive area next to it, you can actually power a light bulb. So it does create energy. And in the vascular system, in any tube filled with fluid, this energy does the work of moving fluid through that tube. And they've done this in Pollock's lab. They've put a hydrophilic tube in water, and they just shine infrared light on it, and the water starts moving through the tube with no pump, no other force whatsoever. It just starts moving. And so that's how the blood moves. Is in our vascular system, we get structured water forming in the artery that moves the fluid through the lumen of the artery. So that's one way that it moves. Another way that it moves is something called paramagnetism, which means that magnetic things, like we talked about how the heart has an electromagnetic field.
Yeah.
Well, also most of the organs and tissues do as well. It's just not as strong as the heart's. And so there is this aspect of the iron in the blood, a paramagnetic, and oxygen is also paramagnetic, being attracted to those magnetic fields. So, you know, it gets close enough to one of those things and it's attracted toward that tissue. And then the heart brings it back through the veins because of its large electromagnetic field, but it all keeps moving in the same direction because of structured water moving it that direction. And then the third thing that helps blood move is that structured water also forms on the elements of blood. So the red blood cells and lipoproteins and all the aspects of blood, it forms on those. And because it's very electronegative, it creates this charge of negativity around the elements of blood. And so they don't like to stick together. You know, the like charges repel each other. But also because of that structure, that electronegative area, there's a positive area around it because of the hydrogens. And so it's attracted to the hydrogens. So they're kind of, they call these electrostatic properties, where they don't get too close together. They don't clump together, but they still kind of stay linked, kind of like train cars. They're not completely connected, but they are linked a little bit. And those train cars just move like this. So if things get moving, we all know if a train gets moving and you just stop the engine, it's going to move for a while. You know, it's not just going to slow down like that and stop. So like as we get that momentum of things linked together, it creates this cohesive momentum through the blood that keeps things just moving in the right direction. So lots of different aspects of how blood moves, but the main one is the structured water creating that energy gradient that moves things along.
It's very interesting. In your book, you said some experiments in the dogs, if I'm correct, that even after that, the blood continues to flow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like there's been a few, well, they did these experiments originally in the 40s, and then they repeated them in the 60s, and other scientists repeated them in the 60s. Yeah, and they showed that after the heart of a dog was stopped, that the blood continued to move. And in those second experiments, they showed that it continued to move for up to 2 hours after the death of the animal. And actually, more recently, I think in 2020, it was published in Dr. Pollock's lab. And I actually have a video on my computer from their lab that shows that after they did this in chick embryos, they're looking at the microscope of the chick embryo arteries. And when they euthanize the chick and the heart stops beating, the blood continues to move. At first, like the heart stops and the blood kind of like, you know, kind of like shakes around and it gets all confused, but then it continues to move. It just continues to go after that. And then they have a video of like they're filming it like 16, 17, 18 minutes after the heart stopped and the blood's continuing to move. And if they put the red light or the infrared light on it, it continues to move faster. And you can see the little red blood cells in there moving. It's fascinating.
The infrared light is going to be a kind of energizing stimulus to the fourth phase water, this structured water in the blood.
Yeah, it's the, at least in Dr. Pollock's lab, it is the energy form that is most absorbed by water. So particularly the 3,000 nanometer wavelength, which is the very far infrared, the very far wavelength of light that comes from the sun. Is that 3,000 nanometer wavelength of infrared light. And that's the most absorbed by water. It builds structured water the most. But there's other forms of energies that do it too, like near infrared or red light or pretty much all these different forms of light will help build structured water. It's just that infrared does it the best, which makes sense evolutionarily, again, because the sun is 42% infrared light. So all life is getting this energy from the sun through water and light. You know, that's how it works.
And literally all our energy is coming from the sun, not just about the energy that move our body parts through the ATP made in mitochondria, but the energy that are moving our blood in the blood vessel. That's a very interesting concept.
All of our energy from everything comes from the sun. People think, well, what about food? We get energy. Well, guess where the energy in food comes from? The sun.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, so it's all the sun. And then like you can put your feet directly on the earth and soak up energy from the earth. But that also comes from the sun, because the sun is concentrating energy into the ionosphere, and when that gets excited enough from the ionosphere, lightning strikes, and that's when it strikes the earth, it deposits the electrons in the earth, and then we can soak it up from the earth. So it's all coming from the sun. Like everything is powered by this star, our star, from the sun. And so based on that, it makes absolutely no sense that the sun is bad for you, which, because it's not.
Yeah.
Which is this thing that people have been convinced of, unfortunately. But yeah, like that's literally powering everything. And there's just many ways that our bodies can harvest this energy. One is through, we have metabolism where we can eat food and break down the chemical bonds in food and use that to create electrons. And those electrons can be passed down the electron transport chain in the mitochondria, and we can get ATP from that, which ATP has different roles than we think, but also we can put our feet directly on the earth, and through our collagen fascia system, we can soak up electrons directly from the earth. We have melanin in our skin, and all animals have this. Melanin can take energy from the sun and convert it into electrons for us. So can the molecule DHA. DHA has a pi electron cloud around it that when light hits it, it gets excited and creates an electrical current of electrons. And that can be used. So we have multiple ways that we can gain energy from our environment. It's not just food. And the problem becomes that when we're living in this state of poor mitochondrial health, and then we try and eat food to get enough energy, just food, because we're not getting energy from other places, then we get this mitochondria that's trying too hard to create that energy, and it's also unhealthy, so we get lost energy. And lost energy becomes stored fat. And that creates this cardiometabolic disaster that can happen with insulin resistance and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So if you can say that this fear mongering about the sun is not just a problem of vitamin D, it's a problem for the whole body in every aspect from mitochondrial health to cardiovascular health, we are getting in trouble because we are some of the trouble because we are isolating us from the sun.
Definitely, yeah. We have living indoors in general, like, and just being away from the sun, and actually not just the sun, but the sun, the cycles of the sun and how it differs throughout the year, that kind of stuff. But yeah, being convinced, and then also, like the sunglasses that tell your body that it's not daytime, or all the sunscreens and things we put on our skin to protect us from the sun. Like, you're blocking all the benefits of the sunlight. And people may say, yeah, but too much sun will give you cancer. Well, there's absolutely no evidence for that. And there's actually studies that I've found that show that the more sunlight people get, the less incidence of melanoma they have. And also that people with melanoma, the more sun they get, the more UVA and UVB they get, dictate whether or not they survive the melanoma. Like, so the more sun they got, the more likely they were to survive the melanoma. So there's no evidence, and it's likely that skin cancer is driven by toxicity of the body, by the things that we put on our skin to protect us from the sun. Those things are super toxic, sunscreens and lotions and makeups and all this kind of stuff, but also the not being synced up with the day-night cycle of the sun, because when you're not synced up with the day-night cycle, you don't go through a daily or a nightly detoxification through melatonin production that eventually ends up with dysfunctional mitochondria, dysfunctional cells that become cancerous. So it's all through the sun. Like, it's all our disconnect from the sun. That's what's driving cancer. It's not the sun at all.
In a broader sense, this disconnection from the nature itself, because you said sun, and you said grounding or earthing, as you wish, and we are just walking on artificial flora and not getting enough sun, and eating ultra processed, I don't really call it food, but ultra processed things, and this is the formula for disaster.
Yeah, definitely. But the thing is it's divorcing us from our energy.
Yeah.
You know, we really, you know, these processed foods are damaging to our metabolism, damaging to our mitochondria. And then, so we try and fuel ourselves with those things. We end up with this very sick and diseased state because we have too many calories that the mitochondria can't deal with because they're damaged. And then we have not enough nutrients, which is, you know, food should be about proteins, vitamins, and minerals. That's what it should be about. You shouldn't worry so much about the macros and all this stuff. Just get proteins, vitamins, and minerals from your food, which animal foods are the best source of that, the most bioavailable source of that. And then get energy from other places like the sun and grounding. And so, because the energy you do need from food will come when you focus on getting protein, vitamins, and minerals, you know, so like if you eat a steak, there's going to be some energy from that you'll burn, but you're going to get energy from other places too. And so really in this kind of, distancing ourselves from nature that we've done as a society, especially in the West, has divorced us from our energy sources. Right. And then people are just so drained, they're trying to get energy, all the energy from food, and it's creating this metabolic disaster. But it makes sense because, you know, we lived outside we only had natural light until 18, whatever it was, 80 something, when Edison invented the light bulb. But even then, that was incandescent bulbs. Now, you know, and then you get the more modern processed blue lighting. That's only been around since like 1970. So it's a very quick change. You know, from having only sunlight or firelight, which was not strong enough to affect the circadian rhythm and stuff, to these artificial lights that we have on all the time, especially if you live in a city, that is totally disrupting, you know, the signaling for your body. Not just the lack of sunlight and getting the energy, but now we're disrupting timing through lighting. It's just we're getting the wrong information, right? Remember, your body is trying to sense information, and the light environment that we have today, artificial light environment, is just totally throwing that off.
Yeah, in the I think we are in a path that we already passed 50% the way, and we cannot turn it back. Mm-hmm. We are not going back to the caves, to the forests, and to the sunlight. We have to do something with what we have. So I think we have the opportunity, me, you, and all the people to do this kind of posts and talking and lives and podcasting, that we can make the technology work for us in favor of our health quality and lifestyle and things like that. So I saw some pictures in your Instagram that you have an infrared sauna and you have the infrared sauna, but you take some sun. And so what are the time you spent in sun and infrared sauna? You go infrared sauna when you don't have sun outside. I think we have some real technology that we can use to at least mitigate some of the effects of this disconnection.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really like you said, you know, I don't expect people to go live in a cave again or just go camping all the time, something like that. That's not realistic for most of us. So we just have to find ways that we can sort of recreate this more natural environment within the context or confines of our modern day lives. I get as much sun as possible, and I'm very fair skinned. I have Irish heritage, you know, so people think, oh, you're gonna burn, and I found that if I burn, the reason that I would burn in the past is because I would never go out in the sun and stuff, and then at midday when it's UVB, I go out and my body's not ready for that. But if I get sun throughout the seasons and I get it throughout the day, like I my body sees sunrise and then it sees UVA rise later, then it's way more prepared to receive that stronger sun in the summer and at midday in the summer. So and then I still be smart about it. I don't want to burn because that feels bad, but it's not necessarily like the cause of skin cancer or anything. It's just that it sucks to burn. I kind of prepare myself for that. But then I also do these, I also have an infrared sauna that I use a lot more in the winter because I'm not out in the sun as much, even though I still go out. And if you look at my Instagram in the winter, I still go out and I still getting sunlight. I use that because this day and age, there's a lot of dehydrating things. And the number one way to structure water in the body is infrared light. And so we're exposed to electromagnetic fields, whether we like it or not. We're exposed to toxins, whether we like it or not. And so these are like an infrared sauna, a way for me to get more concentrated dose of that infrared that structures the water, but it also helps keep my body, which has benefits. I sweat, and when you sweat through infrared light, you release way more toxins. So I'm getting rid of those toxins that are interfering with structured water. So I think it's an incredibly useful tool to combat our modern way of life, especially in the winter when there's not as much, you don't get as much infrared or sunlight. But yeah, you know, and I have, I spend as much time as I can grounding every day.
Yeah.
But like right now, I have an indoor grounding mat. My feet are on a grounding mat right now because if I'm sitting in front of my computer.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And so like those can be useful. It's not as good as feet on the earth, and you always want to do that first. But they can be useful, right? And I have grounding sheets so that, you know, when I'm sleeping, I can get some electrons into my body. So different things like that, different modern day things that we can use to create this light or this environment that's better. And then I'm very diligent about my light environment as far as like when the sun goes down, my lights go off, you know, or I only use incandescent bulbs and I'm wearing blue blocking glasses because I don't want any blue light telling my body that the sun is up. And I never wear sunglasses because that tells my body that the sun is down. And I don't want that. I want it to know when the sun is up and when the sun is down. It's very important for our physiology to get those signals day in and day out. It's not just about light exposure on the skin. It's about the timing of that. And so that's kind of how I, you know, change things about my modern environment as best I can, because not all my environments are that way. But to make it more synced up to what it would be if I was living in the woods all the time, you know. And then obviously in the woods, I'd only have whole foods and they would only be local and they'd only be in season because I wouldn't have the option to ship foods around the world. And so actually the light environment stored in food can give your body confusing signals if it's shipped from around the world, grown in a different light environment than my body's environment is in. That can be confusing and create inflammation in the body. So I eat local and in season so that, you know, I'm trying to, again, recreate what it would be like if my body was living in nature. And that's the only thing I had. I had to survive in nature the best I can within my modern environment.
Yeah. The your diet is not carnivore diet. You eat fruits and vegetables, or you?
I don't eat any fruit because I'm type 1 diabetic, and it's just easier to control blood sugars if I don't have any very, very low or any carbs. But I'm not opposed to fruit in season. Like evolutionarily, humans would have only had fruit when it was in season, depending on where you live. In Brazil, you probably got fruit year round. I'm guessing.
Yeah,
I don't know.
We have some fruits. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's more evolutionary appropriate because that's where you live, right? Whereas in my environment in Virginia, in the United States, like there's no fruit here right now. There's no carbs anywhere. There's no plant foods really available. And so if I was living in the wild, animal foods would be my only thing. So in the winter, I'm carnivore. But then when I go to the farmers markets in the late spring, I'll start to see some local vegetables that I'll eat sometimes. You know, I get like a few per week, some cucumbers or some summer squash or something like that, something that's grown locally. And I'll eat that as long as I can get it locally. And then when I can't anymore, it's pretty much back to animal foods. I would say that for the average person, yeah, it's okay to eat fruit when it's in season. And the thing is that the calories that you burn are very tied to the temperature. So if you live near the equator where it's warm and there's fruit year round, your body never adapts to being cold.
Yeah.
And the problem is that when you adapt to being cold and you also eat carbohydrates, which never would have been available if it was cold, then that creates a mismatch, right? Between your evolved physiology and your modern environment. And that creates lots of problems for mitochondria. So if you live in a place where it's warm all the time, and there's foods that are carbohydrates because your body's never having to adapt to the cold. So it's okay to eat those carbohydrates, not processed carbohydrates, but like whole food carbohydrates.
Okay.
Is what I'm talking about during that time, because your body's never really having to adapt to the cold. It's very tight. It's like, it's crazy when you look at all this stuff and how tied we are to the seasons and the temperature and the food that's available. And then when we totally screw that up and we're just doing everything like crazy, then it really affects our health, and our bodies are like, what the heck's going on?
Yeah.
It's just our body's just trying to do the best that it can, but it's just getting all these crazy signals that it can never evolve to or adapt to, because evolution takes many, many generations, way more like 30, 40, 50 generations to actually create change, which is a long time.
And switching gears a little to talk about a little about stress.
Mm-hmm.
And in your book, you said about you talk about stress being the main cause of cardiovascular disease. Can you tell a little bit about that and the difference between the stress from today, the stress from 200,000 years ago, and mm-hmm. something?
Yeah, you know, stress, it's a huge driver in cardiovascular disease because it increases clotting factors. And you look at mm-hmm. cardiovascular disease, whether it's atherosclerosis, strokes, heart attacks, things like that, they're all clotting. It's all clotting material. It's not a buildup of cholesterol, you know, it's clotting material, all of it. When you analyze those things, that's what it is. When someone has a heart attack or a stroke, they don't give them cholesterol enzymes, they give them clot busting enzymes, right? So that's what it is. And so stress, chronic stress, and then acute stress definitely raises clotting factors. And the reason that is because evolutionarily, if we were under a stress, it usually means we're running for our lives.
Yeah.
And so we're about to get injured, we're fighting something off, right? And so if we're about to get injured, our body's preparing to clot, because if we start bleeding, it wants to clot and prevent us from bleeding out and dying, right? So that's why that happens. But we live in this modern world where humans have a very large prefrontal cortex that allows us to be the only species that can really think our way into a stress response. And so that foresight has given us many benefits. It's gotten humans to where they are today. However, in our modern world, you know, we can create a lot of things that we can think our way into that stress response. Like, we can see something stressful happen to somebody else and fear it's going to happen to us. Or now we have the news that we can look at worldwide and see about all the stresses throughout the whole world, which never would have happened evolutionarily. We only would have known what was happening pretty much to us, and that's it. You know, even a mile away, we may not even be knowing what's happened, right? And now we just have all the information all at once, and it's very stressful to these minds of ours that can think our way into a stress response. And so it's become this mismatch, and now we have this issue of chronic stress where you're thinking you're in a stress response when you're not actually in a life-threatening situation, but your body's having a life-threatening reaction, and it's happening almost all the time. And part of that is improper signaling from the environment. Like, if your body doesn't know what time it is and where it is, that's very stressful to it. But then a lot of it is just the day-to-day, modern-day stresses of life, you know, like how stressful it is to feel like, I mean, these days it's like everyone's on their own. You got to make your own way, which is stressful, because evolutionarily you would have been in a group of 100 to 150 people. Everyone would have been doing their job to create the success of the tribe of people. Yeah. You know, everybody would have helped out. We all pitched in. Everybody, like, they go and had a kill of an animal, then everybody shared it. And now it's very individualized. Like, we have to make our own way, which is, it doesn't mean that we don't have people that support us and everything, but it is, you got to make your own money. You got to provide your own place to live. And that's, it's stressful, right? So it's a little bit different than, you know, the social aspect of humans as it was evolutionarily. So it's interesting when you think about that stuff. And how we've come away from that, and how really it's civilization that's created those mismatches, living in. So not that I'm saying we shouldn't be in civilizations, but we just have to think about that, which is why it's super beneficial when people like find their tribe. You know, they find their people that are doing the same thing, or when they have a really good work environment where everyone at the environment is doing what's best for the company as a whole, and they love their job because of that, where everybody's working together. You know, we feel that connectedness, and it's like people like that just have better health outcomes, you know. All that's interesting.
Yeah. And you talk about find your tribe, and nowadays we have the obligation to work, we have the obligation to find some job. And I think I don't have any data to back this up, but I think that most people don't find something they like to do. They do they have the job just to make some money to survive. And I was a person like that for almost 25 years of my life. And man, when I find my place, when I find my tribe, when I find my thing to do, I just have a stress relief that is amazing. Mm-hmm. And the quality of life is wonderful if you are doing what you love to do. You are working, of course. I don't buy that thing that you love what to do that you are not going to work any day in your life. I don't buy that. I think what I do is work. I put myself in, but it's very reward, and the sensation that it gives is the contrary of stress.
Mm-hmm.
If that is a that word,
yeah,
and it's
until
it's
you have very, purpose,
yeah, they give you purpose. It's very, very interesting, and we have nowadays we have the chronic stress. We have the bills to pay. We have the kids that we have to take to school, pick them back, and they are fighting in the other room. And you have the boss that wants you to do something that you don't want to do. And that all this stressful situations of the modern life makes you grumpy. You be angry all the time, and you gotta have some escape valve, and you find ultra processed foods to escape from at least from that stress. And I think that we have as I say, the perfect storm to cardiovascular disease.
Definitely, yeah. And there's a lot of factors, but it all comes back to what we're told is normal within modern society, or what appears normal, because everybody's doing it, right? Everyone's eating processed food. Everyone, not everyone, but lots of people, everyone's using indoor lighting and modern indoor lighting. It's just like, it's normal, right? And to opt out of those things, you're almost seen as weird, And so, but if you look at it and you see these things that are conveyed as normal, is what everybody's doing, well, that's also why people think that chronic disease is normal, because it's just so common. It's not normal. It's just common. Yeah. Because the things that we are doing is common, that are common to everybody, like artificial lights and the artificial foods and all that stuff, they're common, and they're also causing this abnormal thing, right? So none of this is really normal compared to where the way humans have lived for the vast majority of time that we've been on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, and what about LDL? the great culprit of cardiovascular disease today is LDL, but as you talk in your book, it isn't. I'm with you on that. But what can you say about LDL, and does it have any impact on cardiovascular health?
So all that. You take a lipid panel or a cholesterol panel, all that can really tell you is what your body's metabolizing at the time, right? Is it metabolizing more glucose, then your LDL may go down. If you're metabolizing more fat, then your LDL may go up, because your body's delivering that fat to the tissues because it needs to burn it, right? So that's the only thing that can really tell us. And if you measure like oxidized LDL or particle size, so that you can get some sense of like inflammation in the body. Or if you measure like the trig to HDL ratio, you can get some sense of insulin resistance. But for the most part, when you're looking at a cholesterol panel, all it tells you is about what you're metabolizing at the time. It doesn't tell you risk of anything really. And so, like I said, heart disease is clotting. It's when clots form. Whether clots form in small, chronically over time, we get atherosclerosis, or it forms acutely, we get a heart attack or a stroke. Is clotting. So when we look at what we need to measure to prevent heart attack risk, it's markers of clotting. And that's not always something that you get a medical test for. So you could take things like inflammatory markers that could tell you risk of clotting. you could take things like erythrocyte sedimentation rate, which is like how likely elements of blood are to clump together. You could take markers of how well blood is flowing, like nitric oxide or flow mediated dilatation, things like that. But in the end of the day, all those things are hyper realities. They're things that we're taking as more real than we're actually real. And, you know, they're just snapshots in time of one tissue of the body. It doesn't really tell us about how well your body is doing day in, day out throughout the day. And so, like, real measurements to me that will assess your risk of something is, how is your light environment? How often are you getting sunlight versus artificial light? You know, how often are you grounding? You know, how often are you spending time outside? How often are you eating processed food versus unprocessed foods? What is your relationships like? How many positive, loving relationships do you have versus toxic relationships do you have? Like, that's all those things are an indicator of how at risk you are of a disease, right? And you can look at the body and specific things in the body too, but the real markers of risk are how you're living your life day in and day out. And of course, there's outliers and there's people that, you know, quote unquote, live this best life and they're doing all the right things and they still get diseases. That's because the modern world is, you know, pretty against us. And there's an aspect to how adapted your genes are to this modern world versus some people's that aren't. And so there's all those different factors. But generally, on a day-to-day basis, the average person, it's like, that's the way you measure risk. It's not this cholesterol panel that you dictate all your risk of heart disease on. That makes no sense. But it's how you're living your life and how much time you spend doing these healthy things versus non-healthy things. Like, that's the best indicator. Like, I wouldn't wait till I go get my blood work and be like, oh, this means I got to do something. It's like, you do something every day, right, regardless. Because whether or not that test says that you're at risk or you're not at risk, you know, the way to keep it, the way to decrease the risk, if it is at risk, or keep it from being a risk, is to do these things every day. So just go and do those things. That's the best way forward.
Great. Dr. Hussey, it was just great. I want to be respectful with your time, and it was just a great chat, great talk. I thank you very much for your time. And I always ask for a book recommendation in the end of my life. Not a book that has to be in your area, but a book that marked your life, that made a dent in your life. So, do you have any book like that?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say that it's
you can say your book, because your book is one of the ones that made that in my life.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. That's great. Well, you know, because I was thinking, because you asked me that prior to this, and I was thinking about a book that I read, because there's so many books, and I had one that was more in my field. But then when you phrased it like that, when you just asked me a book that's kind of had a mark on my life, it's actually a book by my favorite author, which is Michael Crichton, which people may know him as the guy who wrote Jurassic Park. And he's since passed, but he had a very good way of weaving in like science and philosophy of science and into his books, even though they're fiction books. However, he did write a few nonfiction books. And one of them is called Travels, where he just kind of talks about, you know, different experiences of his life and what he learned from those experiences. And it's very different because it was back in the 80s. Than today, but I just gained a lot of insight from that book, and I really like it because when I go back and look at books, like, I highlighted and underlined more in that book than I did in most other books, most like science books and stuff. And you know, if I read it today, it may not be as impactful, but back when I read it first, which is probably 15 years ago, it was very impactful to me. Just him telling these stories of his life from his very inquisitive and curious and introspective way about life that he seems to approach. And it was just useful to me. So I really like that book, Travels, by Michael Crichton.
Great. Dr. Hussey, thank you very much for your time. Thank you very much for this great chat. I hope you are going to, you come to Brazil. Why not?
I would love to travel. I would love to.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to see your next work, your next book. Yeah, is there anyone in the
Oh
horizon? Yeah, that's great.
it's getting hopefully closer and closer, so to
Great,
being
great.
so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.